Well, I'm very pleased to welcome to Fremantle Shipping News Dr. Josh Byrne. Welcome, Josh.
Thank you.
Now, we're in the rooms of Josh Byrne and Associates in, well, just off Cantonment Street in the centre of Fremantle, in a rather delightful building. How long have you been here?
We've been here for 3 years. We were fortunate to take on this space just as the building was being completed, the renovation. The shell of the building is the famous Atwell Arcade. It's been in Fremantle for well over probably 120 years. But the core of the building has been renovated, and so we have this lovely mix of the old and the new.
Now, I've tried to introduce you to our listeners in this very obscure way, Dr. Josh Byrne and Josh Byrne and Associates, and in an office here in the centre of Fremantle. But there are many, many people out there who know you just as Josh Byrne from Gardening Australia. How long have you been doing that?
This is my 18th year.
18th year?
18th year.
You can't be old enough to...
Well, I started young. I've been, on the show for 18 years as a regular presenter. I first made my appearance on the show 20 years ago. I was a guest. I had a student garden in Dalkeith where I was renting whilst I was studying my undergraduate degree. I was there for years and had created a wonderful permaculture garden, and the ABC got wind of that and came and did a two-part story with me. And they offered me a job after that, which was a surprise. I couldn't take it straight away. I had other things to finish, firstly my degree, and then I went travelling for a year to go overseas and do some volunteer work. And when I came back, the offer was still there, so I grabbed it and am still doing it.
Now, let's just talk about your, if you like, formal training and qualifications and experience. And you've already started to touch on it as a student with permaculture. But just tell us a little bit about your formal qualifications and then how you got into what you got into.
So I studied environmental science as my undergraduate degree at Murdoch, which was a great place to study that course. At the time, it was recognised as one of the top universities to study environmental science. I studied part-time. I did my undergrad degree over 6 years. And for most of that time, I worked at the university. I was very fortunate to pick up a part-time job working for a research and development group which ran a demonstration centre called the Environmental Technology Centre, which looked at demonstrating small to medium scale appropriate technologies around the areas of energy and water and waste management, housing, food and landscaping. And by this stage, I was already a very keen gardener, and it was that food and landscaping angle that got me in. In my very early undergraduate degrees, I ran a little gardening round, being a keen gardener, to sort of help pay the student bills. And that skill set led me to being quite useful to that research group, who were mainly engineers and were doing the sort of harder tech stuff. So it was sort of a soft entry into working for that research group. So I studied and worked part-time for that period. After a bit of travel, I came back and I did my honours with that same research group. And by this stage, having been immersed in the sort of research and development space, I was working as a professional officer, but all my colleagues were either doing their PhDs or were postdoctoral researchers, and of course my employers were typically either associate professors or professors. So I was kind of indoctrinated into that academic, you know, hierarchy, if you like. But they were a great group. And there was always an expectation on me, if I was to stay there and continue working with that group, doing wonderful work, then I would continue with postgrad studies. So,
and you'd do your doctorate eventually.
That's correct. So that's what I did. I completed my honours. My honours project was looking at the role of a low-cost soil moisture controller for improving water use efficiency in domestic irrigation on sandy soils. It was quite a specific piece of work, experimental in its nature, and very much a good fit with my interest in gardening and permaculture at that stage. It was a project that we did with Water Corporation as an industry partner. They were keen to see how devices such as these could help save water in Perth. So my research work at that point is very applied. I did well in that. I was fortunate to get first class honours. It was a project that I threw myself into. And what was interesting when I finished that, and of course that was a pathway to get into a PhD, I was fortunate to get a PhD offer as well as a scholarship. And my project was to be framed around the notion of sustainable urban landscapes, and in particular the role of various water sources and localised water sources in particular.
Now, what years are we talking about here when you're concentrating on the PhD
project? So I kicked off in 2003. Interestingly, it was the same year that I got that phone call from the ABC to say, hey, are you back from your travels? We're looking for a WA presenter. The old one had left. Would you like to have a go? And I said, why not? So I started in that same year, both my PhD and the TV presenter role. And I've got to say, the TV presenter role was something that I had really no expectations really to go anywhere. I had no background or training in it.
That was going to be my next question. At what point did you go out and get media training? I think with you it probably just comes naturally.
Well, it's the kind of nature of that role as being a presenter on Gardening Australia and no doubt other programs like it that are kind of factual based programs, in that we're not actors. We are subject matter experts that clearly can get their words out when the camera's pointed at them. So it was all on the job training. Clearly, when I was a guest on the show, there was something about what I was doing that hit the mark. I think the timing is very good in terms of subject matter. Just going back a step, I've always been a keen gardener.
Let me get you to pause there.
Sure.
I have to discover, people will want to know, where did that come from? Not every young guy coming out of high school and going off and doing environmental science at Murdoch or anywhere else is a keen gardener of any sort. Where did this all come from?
Well, looking back on it, I guess my interest in gardening really started to become clear to me when I was about 14 or 15. My father was a very keen amateur cook. He was a lawyer by profession, but was a very good cook, and cooking was one of his ways to kind of de-stress at the end of the day. And what he had was this incredible herb collection on the back deck, and it was one of these old school herb collections where each herb was in its own terracotta pot, stacked up on a rack. And one of my jobs, I grew up with Dad during my high school years, one of my jobs was to make sure all of those herbs were in top nick. So I had to water them, I had to fertilise them, propagate them, repot them, and I really enjoyed it. The other thing we always had, and this was basically two bachelors living together, Dad and son, we had the most magnificent flower display on the front of our Federation-era home in Subiaco. Big hanging baskets that would be mass planted with petunias in summer and pansies in winter. We would have people driving past, stopping, getting out, taking photos of these displays. They were fantastic. And Dad and I would do those replantings together. So I think clearly something was sparked there. By the age of about 15 or 16, Dad could see that I was pretty keen on gardening. He had some old gardening books. He was a book collector also, and still is. That's one of his hobbies. And he had some old gardening books, including first edition copies of Permaculture 1 and Permaculture 2, which were the original sort of texts that were prepared by Bill Mollison and David Holmgren. And I read those and could see that there was more to this gardening business than just growing herbs and pansies, as fun as engaging as that was, but really the role of gardening and productive landscapes had a big role to play in kind of, you know, healthy and sustainable communities, if you like. So the next little step for me was Dad said, well, why don't we set up a veggie garden? So another book that he had was the No Dig Gardening by Esther Dean, which was also known as the lasagna style gardening, where you layer up, you know, straw and compost and newspaper and grass clippings and weeds and other stuff. So I, Dad and I went down to the supply yard and got a bootload of gear and came back. And over the weekend, we set up a 4 square meter patch, which over the next few years grew. I took over the back lawn. I had passion fruit and climbing tomatoes on the fence, and we had veggies and the whole of it. And it really, really felt good to me. I just liked having the hands in the soil. I liked seeing stuff grow. And I was pretty quiet about it at school because it wasn't the coolest thing, you know, a teenager gardening. And, you know, really, I think probably by the time I got to upper high school and was looking to do my TE, my interest in gardening had kind of opened my eyes to broader environmental issues around soil and water. So I started to pick units like geography and biology. And I would say I had a true environmental, you know, awareness happening at that point. So, you know, really, that's what led me to study environmental science, was an interest in gardening, making the links between gardening at that sort of local site level and the greater environment around me. And I wanted to learn how to do that better. And one of the great things about studying environmental science is a fairly broad undergraduate degree is you learn all of those fundamental earth sciences that inform how to do what I do better.
And we're going to have to get back to them if we have left them, I expect. Let me ask you this. You told us about your honours project. When you embarked on your PhD, what was your final dissertation topic?
Apologies for long-winded and dry title. my final thesis is coined Mains Water Neutral Gardening, an Integrated Approach to Water Conservation for Sustainable Urban Landscapes.
Well, I'm very impressed that you remember it all exactly. And I think there must be a colon in there somewhere.
Yes, there was a colon. Yeah.
Now when you were doing the PhD, when you entered upon that, and you've described the milieu in which you were working and researching at the time, did you imagine, even though there was this question of the ABC on the side, and that no doubt was a lot of fun, that you were going into an academic career?
I guess from that early time working as initially a research assistant and then a professional officer by the time I sort of finished up that role at Murdoch with that research group that I mentioned, I was already by that stage, even as an undergraduate, giving lectures to other undergraduates in the courses that my bosses ran. A particular unit, Environmental Technology for Sustainable Development, which covered all these areas of energy, water, waste and what have you. There was a particular unit that looked at water efficiency in landscaping and the role of landscaping for urban health. So I had the practical experience and so they threw me in the deep end. It wasn't too long after that I was tutoring as well. So I started to get a bit of a feel for it. I was included on a few publications, so I had a bit of a taste of academic life. But I really enjoy the applied nature of it all. To me, academia is a great way to pursue knowledge, to remain at the forefront of new ideas. It's a fertile space to be in generally, but it's the applied that really excites me.
Now, one thing you're also known very well for, particularly around Fremantle, is Josh's place, where you've applied all of your experience and your theories in relation to energy and water and waste and just about everything else you've mentioned. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. So we have our family home in Hilton, which of course is in the city of Fremantle. It's the fourth home and garden, if you like, that I've lived in, and particularly the gardens that I've fixed up in Fremantle over the 18 odd years four gardens, three of which have been in Fremantle in the 18 years that I've been on the show. Each of them, up until this latest one, were all rentals, which is interesting. And, you know, we were kind of the landlord's dream there. I'd rent a place and fix up the garden on the show and test ideas and learn things and then move on to the next one. And I should say, in my PhD, which had three major case studies, all of those three case studies are all in Fremantle. But this latest one, our family home, which was finally a place that we decided to buy a piece of land, and rather than fixing up an old rental, we said, look, let's actually plan this and design it and build it from scratch, which was great. We bought a block with my sister-in-law, and we designed and built the two homes together, one for my family, one for hers. And it was an opportunity to not only look at the landscape and landscape water elements, but really to look at integrated planning at the household site level of energy efficient housing design that's thermally comfortable year round without the need for air conditioning, that has fantastic indoor air quality, that is cost effective to run, that generates more power than it uses, that collects and recycles most of its own water, and of course is surrounded by a shady, diverse, productive and engaging garden.
I noticed on the conversation the other day that it's a wonderful university based place for all sorts of publications, that someone said that if we could plant more trees in the backyards giving coverage, you could probably reduce the ambient air temperature in those places by 6 or 7 degrees. It's a really interesting concept.
Yeah, certainly. The role of trees in urban areas is significant in terms of keeping them cool and comfortable. And one of the challenges that we have managing infill in urban environments, which of course is important to limit the sprawl of our cities and to make cities more vibrant and vital and efficient to run as far as transport and servicing goes. How we do that without compromising green space, of course, is one of the great urban planning challenges.
Mm. Now, let's segue for a moment, although I don't think we're segueing all that far, to the work that Josh Byrne and Associates does and has been doing since, when did you say you started?
I set the company up 15 years ago when I was doing my PhD for that first year or two on a pretty lean scholarship, as they are, and also doing my presenting work with the ABC. And, of course, being a weekly show, only half an hour as it was back then, now it's an hour, but a half-hour show with presenters in all the states, and we share that, it wasn't a great deal of work. And of course, contrary to popular belief, TV presenting, and particularly the ABC, isn't the kind of thing you retire on. It's a labour of love as much as anything. I needed some extra income, so I started to do a little bit of garden design and sort of small-scale consulting work on the side, just as a little sole trader out of the spare room at home. And I soon found growing demand for that. Particularly in that sort of area that is my interest, which is the interface between buildings, so housing in particular, water, energy, and the landscape, and almost a contemporary permaculture framing, if you will. So I soon found myself rushed off my feet, and my PhD was being put on the back burner. And on that note, I should say, after my first year of my PhD, and the Gardening Australia program was going very well, and I was getting more work through that, and the consulting work was picking up. So I went part-time with the PhD. So it took me a while to get through it, which ended up being a good thing because it meant I had all that time for those great case studies that I built and monitored. But anyway, the consulting work started to pick up, and within a couple of years, I realised that I needed to start getting some support. So I looked at putting my first employee on. I thought, best thing to do is get organised with your time and your finances. So I went on the hunt and found a pretty quality personal assistant, hired them, and I soon realised, look, I can't really have a staff member coming to my home office in the spare bedroom. It's not a good look. We might need to go out and actually rent somewhere. So at this point, my then girlfriend, now wife, were renting one of these houses we fixed up in South Fremantle. I saw a place for rent or buy at the bottom of Johnson Court there on Adelaide Street. I looked at the price and I thought, that's got to be a mistake. It's a printing error. I'll go have a look at this place. So I rang the agent and went down and had a look, and sure enough, it was one of those commercial suites on the bottom of Johnson Court, and any of the listeners from Fremantle would know that landmark. Notorious in its day, but it's got a new life, and it's kind of iconic. It's a kind of a crazy example of planning back in the day. But it was an old boarded up shop down below. And anyway, so I ended up scraping whatever pennies I had together and bought that and renovated it, cleaned it up and did a very sensitive, low cost, low energy fit out of that. And that's where I started trading, nearly 15 years ago. Yeah.
Now, you've described the nature of your work and your interest and what you bring to those sustainability areas. The work that you do in Josh Byrne and Associates seems to me to have that public-private face. Would that be a way of describing it?
Yeah, so the work that we do is very much in the urban built environment space.
Give us a couple of examples, sure. Perhaps in the early days and, sure, and now sure, more recently.
Sure. So when I started up all those years ago, working out of Shop 5, as we call it, we were mainly doing residential garden designs and also some guidance on house renovations and retrofitting. We started doing some design guideline work for developers who were interested in providing guidance to new homeowners around, low water use gardens and gardens that also considered habitat and maybe some food production. So I started doing some demonstration gardens and the like, and that was my first foray into working in the urban development sector. That soon got the interest of Water Corporation, who, of course, had seen my work on the ABC, but also that we were doing good applied design projects locally. So we started to look at what Water Corporation was doing with its messaging and started what is now an ongoing relationship with Water Corp, with their leadership around water-sensitive urban design and water-wise design. So I guess very quickly, once we started to work, with some government agencies or trading entities, that then just grew very quickly. And it also soon became clear to me that the exciting space to work in isn't so much residential gardens. I had done a lot of that and I was still mainly covering that on the show. But there was an opportunity to start to really move into the public realm. And look at parks and streetscapes and entire urban developments where the scale is more exciting, greater opportunity for impact, and really provides an opportunity to sort of start working again with utilities such as Water Corp and others to look at bigger impact stuff.
Tell me at this point, in the broad, what is the impact that one is trying to have, whether it's you or the client, presumably as a partnership on a project like these?
So simply put, we're trying to make urban spaces better. And that is better for people who use them, so more comfortable, thermally in terms of shade and comfort, more attractive in terms of amenity. We're trying to be very mindful of resource usage, not wasting water, how urban spaces can be more energy efficient, how we really understand how urban spaces can have multiple sustainability functions. Environmental services is a term commonly heard. Well, let's look at this idea of sustainability services. How can our built environments move from being resource drains to actually productive spaces? And that's not just food, but that's as water catchment, as places where energy can be generated, that can actually, we can do restorative design that starts to put habitat back in urban centres. I very quickly became quite fascinated in cities and realising that rather than having this reality where people typically live and work in urban areas which are grey and polluted spaces and then have to, go out to regional areas or out to the countryside to holiday and perhaps, retire on acreage somewhere, that's crazy. The reality is cities are, the major habitat for humanity now, and that trend is just growing, 80 plus percent. So how do we make these cities better places. And that's very much the crux of what JBA do today. So, you know, our skill set spans landscape architecture, environmental engineering, and we have skills that span both design and technical, as well as policy and social science. And that is the type of diverse skill set that you need to tackle these urban sustainability issues.
Now, Josh, the summer we've just had, the terrible bushfires in Australia and in Western Australia, with a period, and you'll know the stats exactly, and I'm sort of generalising, but 30 or more years as the rainfall in southwestern Australia has reduced. With the work you've done and the work you're doing, do you see some trends for, in whatever area it is, urban design, the way cities function, the future of cities? You've started to touch on that. You're suggesting we have to get smarter about them because this is where people do in fact live. But do you see trends? Do you see things that you believe perhaps in 20 years' time will be very evident to people then if they're not now?
Absolutely. And that is very clear to me. I think what we're seeing, and this is Australia-wide, and I am fortunate with my work to spend time on projects, both visiting and in some cases working on them, both in a consulting and research capacity around Australia. We're seeing similar trends. All cities are facing similar problems around urban heat, around water scarcity, or imbalance in water temporally, so sometimes not enough, sometimes too much, and flooding. We're seeing significant energy challenges, particularly on the East Coast, and that's been in the news for years now, every summer for the last few years. And of course, there's greater awareness, at least in the community, and unfortunately not yet reflected by our political leaders, about the importance to reduce carbon emissions. So cities, how we design them, or how we retrofit them, how we manage them, can help address all of these. I think some of the wicked problems to date, particularly around energy and water, which have, you know, some of the solutions around, you know, local renewable energy or local water sources and water recycling, up until fairly recently have always been seen as nice to haves and, expensive options to the business as usual. But we're now beginning to see, I think, the serious proponents in urban development, so the top-tier developers, certainly the really forward-thinking policymakers in the various agencies, realise that we need sort of system-scale adoption of a number of these things. If we just look at water management in isolation or energy management in isolation, if we look at water supply separate to drainage in isolation, then all of these things are very hard to make stack up. But when we start to look at layering of all of these essential services and sort of city functions, there is real opportunity for transformation. The other thing we're seeing, of course, in all cities in Australia is the need for greater density, and there's an infill agenda in all capital cities. So that's an opportunity to renew infrastructure, to renew the built environment, and that's where we can do these things most cost effectively, because often when there's constraints, more creative approaches are needed, and that's where I think we have real opportunity.
Let's bring this back to Fremantle, as you have with your three rented houses and your present house, and you live in Hilton, you're within the walls of the Republic of Fremantle, so to speak. Are there examples here of what you've been speaking?
There certainly are. And look, we're very fortunate to be working on two flagship projects within the city of Fremantle, both being led by Development WA, of course, the WA State Government Land Development Agency, and both with strong participation from the city of Fremantle as well, which is terrific. So the first one is WGV in White Gum Valley. It's a 2-hectare medium density development. That's pretty much built now. It's a project where my firm were appointed as the landscape architects and sustainability consultants. And along with the rest of the team working on the project, and obviously led by Development WA, has delivered a project that really showcases what's possible with creative design for infill. It's mixed typology, which simply means there's different types of homes available, from apartments to detached lots to group housing. So different price points, opportunities for affordable housing, but a lot of thought around innovation in energy and water systems, in urban greening and the use of public realm, setting tree canopy targets and creating a really livable space. What's moved on from there, because that project's been a huge success, it's won lots of awards, we have had it extensively documented. It was the subject of a four-year research project supported by the CRC for Low Carbon Living. There's multiple publications. PhD students that I've supervised have done their thesis on it. It's a really, really wonderful project. But of course, we can do much more. It's a springboard for taking some of these ideas and learnings one step further. And the next project we're working on, again with Development WA and a similar team of consultants and collaborators, is East Village, which is the development name for a 1 hectare parcel of the Knutsford Urban Regeneration Precinct. This is a project that's currently under construction. It will consist of 36 townhomes and 2 apartment buildings. It will have a microgrid for energy across the site. The 670 kilowatt hour battery has already been installed, and that microgrid will service all of the homes that will have rooftop PV that charge that shared battery. It will also have a water microgrid consisting of both mains water and strata bore, with the strata bore being fed by local stormwater capture and recharge of the shallow aquifer, in addition to rainwater tanks on all of the lots. The 36 townhomes side has been set up as a strata development, and that's been done so there is a great deal of flexibility with how all of the streets and the public access ways and the public or the shared gardens are designed. And so we've been able to design a landscape which is being built as we speak, actually, that is filled with productive plantings, including fruit trees of all sorts. The types of things that can be a bit more difficult to get into public spaces that will end up being handed over to council, just because, budget constraints and other concerns that local government tends to have with things that are outside the norm. So we see this project not only pushing the boundaries in terms of the environmental design of the buildings and the servicing that I described, but also the landscape. And it's a landscape that really pushes blurs the edges between the private realm, which is the private courtyards of these homes, and the shared spaces such as the public access ways and the streets. A big focus on water-sensitive urban design with permeable paving, roadside swales, rain gardens. Again, the types of things that are difficult to get approved through local government at the moment. So by putting all this on as a strata scheme, it provides a bit of a sandbox environment to do things that are a bit more progressive than one would typically do. So there are two cutting-edge projects. And this last one, East Village, is one to watch because I think it will be one of the flagship projects in this space nationally.
Now, before we draw all of this to a close, there's a few questions. You mentioned PhD students and supervising them. You still maintain, I think, an academic life.
Yes, I do. I have a research fellowship at Curtin University in the School of Design and the Built Environment. So my research work is in the area of sustainable urban development, particularly that interface between buildings, water and energy. My focus is very much applied research, using this notion of living lab research, where we look at paralleling a research agenda with real-life projects and co-creating the research projects with research questions addressing industry need. And I guess it goes right back to my interest in doing things that are applied. But it is a great space to be in. I supervise PhD students as part of that, and we publish. And of course, it provides a great opportunity to to excite the market as well. Often we find proponents, and whether it be state government or from the private sector, they are looking to do something different, but they need to be convinced that there's some kind of supporting framework around that. If they're going to be putting themselves out and doing innovation, there needs to be something to it that gives them, one, some confidence that there's people who know what they're doing here, but also how can they leverage that in terms of, in the case of Development WA, they, as part of their charter, they want to lead and demonstrate and share, which is fantastic. Other proponents might want to make sure that they're learning for the next project. So by putting an academic framework around that leading edge front of innovation curve, I think it helps provide confidence that this stuff does move forward.
Speaking of that sort of research, which is a classic traditional role for starting to paint a picture about what the future can be, are there things there that you can see happening which presently can't be achieved for whatever reason?
Probably the main area where we're seeing that has been around the idea of microgrids and how energy can be shared between users across title. Traditionally that's been very hard to make budge. And also I think, as we start to see greater confidence in things like microgrids or peer-to-peer energy trading more novel ways of sharing water resources, we soon get into the governance space. So it's more than just the technology or some of the safety standards. It's really about how are these systems going to be managed? Yeah. What's the business model behind them? Yeah. And to be honest, the technical side of it's pretty easy. A lot of those ideas have been demonstrated and proven, again, typically in sandbox environments, a little while back. Where the innovation's really happening is around that governance space. So by having this kind of research framework around these projects, it gives all of those participants, including the regulators, some comfort around the rigor and scrutiny that happens and how this is documented and how we learn, warts and all. And then, at least in theory, we should see the things that work get picked up and adopted more widely by industry. Things that don't work so well, why not? If they're worth pursuing, how do we do them better?
Now, there'd be so many more questions I'd love to ask you, but we'll bring this to an end. But before I do, gardening, is it still a passion? Is it like a personal recreation for you, or are there other things that you do?
Look, it's my main thing. It's my main hobby. Gardening it's my anchor. Other than my family, of course, who mean everything to me.
I'm assuming you press them into the garden make sure they do the work.
I'm not one of those dads. I've had to work hard not to do that. But I've got two young children. 10 and 7, who were very interested in joining me in the garden when they were little, as all little kids are, particularly for the fun jobs like harvesting vegetables. And they still come and do what I call the hero jobs. But I have been mindful as they've grown and got their own hobbies, whether it be, art related or other things that are, or sports, I haven't forced them into gardening servitude. I would hope that they find that passion themselves in due course. What I have done is, and again, this has been, to be honest, as much for my own benefit, is I've surrounded them all of their lives in beautiful gardens. And for the last nearly 6 years now, the garden that they have around our home in Hilton. We've designed our home so from every window you can see greenery, and well-considered and well-designed greenery. From the main living areas in the kids' playroom and study, it looks out onto beautiful gardens that are full of flowers and attract birds. And for me, this is so important that we create sanctuaries for ourselves, and homes are where most of us spend most of our time, so they should be beautiful spaces. And by that, I don't mean fancy houses. That's fine for some. Not everyone can afford that, but everyone can make a beautiful garden. So my hobby is gardening. I could easily waste hours in a garden just doing what I do. Of course, I need to balance that with all the other demands of life. So, but it really, for me, it's what I do for exercise. It's what I do for personal well-being. It's what I do for intellectual interest, trying new things in the garden. It's what I do for artistic satisfaction in designing and trying different plant combinations. I'm lucky in it's also what I do for at least part of my work with Gardening Australia. I do lots of my filming from home. And at the end of the day, I think if all of this other stuff was to stop, if I wasn't doing the telly stuff, if my, for whatever reason, my design career changed paths, I would still be gardening. And that's what I think you'll see me doing until day's end.
Now, there's a final question. And it's really back where we started from. You're a Fremantle person. Here we are in the very heart of Fremantle. Tell me why people love Fremantle. Have you got a theory about this? Everyone has, I think.
Yeah, look, I just see it as a wonderful village. I'm not from Fremantle originally. I grew up on the other side of the river, and I grew up in the western suburbs. Both schooled there and had my, you know, as I said, my early student share house in Dalkeith for many years. And I'd always expected that I would end up, you know, not far from where I spent all those years. Whether I could afford to not, it's probably a totally different question, but it's just you tend to expect that you'll stay where you were raised, other than travel and bits and pieces. That's what I knew. But my now wife, but girlfriend, you know, again, this is going back nearly 20 years ago when we started going out. We met at university and we started dating, and when it started getting serious, she said, you know, if this is going to work, you need to move down to Fremantle.
You have to come over the traffic bridge and not go back.
You're going to have to make the big jump. She was from Fremantle, and I kind of didn't quite get that, but I was pretty keen on her. So I did relocate, and it made sense because up until that point I was, you know, having to catch the bus from Dalkeith via the city out to Murdoch every day. It was a bit of a mission. So it did make travel sense as well. But once I moved down here and understood, you know, where things were and got a bit of a feel for it, and started to get a sense for the strength of the local sense of community down here, other than the beautiful setting of the town itself and the beaches and the lifestyle and all of those things which are just drop dead gorgeous, it's really, for me, it's the sense of community. And that's why I call it a village. You know, it's big enough to be able to go about your business and not feel like you're just down the local corner store seeing the same people the whole time. But it's small enough and of a genuine human scale where you feel a sense of belonging to it. So, I mean, I've always worked in Fremantle since I set up the practice. As I mentioned, our first little office was there at Johnson Court. And we still have that, by the way. We've turned that into a little short-term stay accommodation, which is great. So it's a thriving little Frio business. When we outgrew that space, we spent 5 years trading out of the Fremantle Chamber of Commerce, which was great, but we outgrew that. And so that's why we moved to where we are now in the Atwell buildings. But we've always committed to staying in Fremantle and within the CBD of Fremantle. It is such a remarkable place to be able to work. It's great for our staff to be able to get here. For those who don't live in the area, and I must admit, over half of them do, they can ride or walk in. People can train in. If we need to go to meetings in the city, which we try and avoid as much as possible, we'd rather clients want to come down here because they want to come to Fremantle.
The train's fantastic.
Yeah, the train's there. But also, I mean, you know, we're in a building that has got genuine heritage attributes, but the kind of the modern facilities now, and there's a number of these old buildings that are being done up in Fremantle offering this level of amenity now, which is fantastic. And of course, in the next few years, well, we're already beginning to see it, it's the renaissance of Fremantle as we see more professional and creative firms basing themselves here. which then all the spin-offs are there for retail and the rest of the community. But where else can you, walk outside of your office, right down there onto High Street Mall, have all of the convenience of amazing food and coffee, all the eclectic nature of the people of Fremantle and beyond, you can grab a glass of wine or a beer after work, or you can do your shopping down here. It's just, it's too good. Why wouldn't you?
I better slow you down. We'll have everybody invading us. Look, on that wonderful note, let's finish with a COVID-19 foot tap. Beautiful. And thank you very much, Josh, for talking Fremantle Chevy News.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.